Okay. The music disappears. Silence pervades the atmosphere. And it's time for the best session of the day. So all of you who are here are really smart. You could have gone shopping. You could have gone sightseeing. But you are the smartest people at this conference because you've come to the future of this movement. Now, if you've read, as I hope you have, the 2008 UNAIDS report, at least the executive summary, the agency explicitly says, page 19 of the executive summary, that it's weaknesses in health systems that are slowing the scale-up of antiretroviral treatment programs. And they emphasize that it was an intensification of work on strengthening health systems that was going to take us to the next phase of ART rollout. And if you had also been really smart and come to the symposium that we did on Tuesday on HIV prevention, you would have heard some fantastic people saying exactly the same thing around prevention services. So we've got remarkable agreement, and we don't often get remarkable agreement, that across a range of global health initiatives today, it's the health system that's the critical obstacle for progress. Now, on Monday evening, Julio Frank chaired a fantastic symposium launching, I'm sure we're going to hear a bit more about it from Carissa, a WHO program called Maximizing Positive Synergies. And it's an effort to ensure that, to take the example of HIV/AIDS, the funding around HIV/AIDS also delivers health gains in other sectors. Now, sometimes when we're discussing this issue of vertical programs and health systems, vertical, horizontal, diagonal, whatever these words mean, the language used in debates can get a little bit heated. I've seen people talk about a war between these different camps, and that's not very helpful. So this symposium is going to explore in some depth what might be possible. How can increased resources around HIV be managed in the best way for health system strengthening? What do we agree on? What don't we agree on, and what data do we need to get in order to settle our disagreements? And when we do pack up our bags and leave Mexico City, what are we going to do? So the way we're going to work this symposium is this man here, Doric, is going to give you 15 minutes about where we are and options for the future. And then we're going to run down this wonderful panel, and I'll introduce them as we go, to give 5-minute responses to what Doric has said. And then we're going to have a bit of fun. We're going to have some question and answer. And if we have enough time, you two will have a chance to ask some pointed questions, I hope, and then we all finish. And then you can go shopping. So, let us start off. Doric, would you like to give us your 15 minutes on this issue where we are? Please welcome him.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. First of all, I would like to acknowledge Dr. Songan here. Dr. Songan was the Minister of Health in Mozambique when I was working there. And he launched the first AIDS treatment program against the will of most of the donors at that time. They were really reluctant. And the reason why is that they said that it would distort an already fragile and weak health system. They said it would actually kill more people indirectly than save lives. Now today, I believe there are 90,000 people on AIDS treatment in Mozambique, alive because of AIDS treatment. And so I wonder if somehow on the way we indirectly killed 90,000 people somewhere else. Those arguments that were used then are coming back. This is a heading of a recent article saying that massive AIDS projects are threatening African health and they are depleting other African health programs that may have a much greater impact or effect on public health. Is this true? It's a very harsh accusation, but is it a serious one? That's what we try to find out in the workshop. We call it now the Antwerp in Geneva workshop. Initially, it was planned to take place in Antwerp, but we moved it to Geneva because it became a kind of pre-meeting to the first expert consultation on positive synergies. The objective of this workshop was to review the evidence of the effects of the AIDS response on health systems and services, particularly in high prevalence countries, so the findings might not always be relevant for all countries. Participants involved research institutions, representatives of ministries of health, NGOs involved in the implementation of AIDS response, so kind of trying to bring those two tribes at war together and discuss under Chatham House rule, and that was really helpful to get some of the information that you usually don't get when everyone has to be politically correct. What are the findings? First of all, there's a whole discussion that AIDS money or AIDS funding has taken away money for general health services. Now, if we look at the facts, at the evidence, that's not true. These are figures of the period 2001-2005, when PEPFAR and the Global Fund were created. We see a doubling of development assistance for HIV/AIDS, 1.4 billion to 2.6, but at the same time, health sector development increased from 2.3 to 4.7. So actually, it increased just a little bit faster in that period. And if PEPFAR and Global Fund were displacing money, we would have seen it here. Now, there are some worrying findings that in some countries, at least, international funding for disease-specific intervention is crowding out domestic health financing. And this domestic health financing is most often used for the recurrent health expenditure, the salaries, etc. Now, why is this happening? Probably because of health expenditure ceilings imposed by the IMF. And so it is a real issue. It is really problematic. But we should be careful not to blame the wrong people for this or the wrong institutions for this. I mean, it's not the AIDS response that created those ceilings. In fact, AIDS activists have been among the most prominent in challenging the IMF on this and to ask more flexibility or the removal of those ceilings. Then findings on implementation on the ground. The first finding is that the AIDS response contributed and continued to contribute to increased investment in all the building blocks of health systems, the health workforce, supply system, lab facilities, information system. However, there are countries where this increased investment is used or devoted exclusively to disease-specific outcomes. And this is, first of all, a missed opportunity as potential spillover effects for other health services have not been fully realized yet, let's hope. But even in some situations, other health services might have been weakened as increased disease-specific investments are using the building blocks of the health system. Now, there is something strange about this discussion. Sometimes it sounds as if people with AIDS have to justify that for every doctor and nurse they are using, they have to show that they brought additional money for an additional nurse or doctor. Let's not forget, it is their health system as well, and it's normal that part of this health system is used for their treatment. Now, what we find also is that there are a few key factors that seem to make the difference between positive and negative synergies. And perhaps the one that came out the most forcefully of this discussion is the health workforce crisis. This is really the critical factor. Wherever the AIDS response has contributed to more human resources for health, to more professional health workers, or including communities in the delivery of services, there seems to be a positive spillover effect. But the opposite is true as well. Wherever the AIDS response has neglected the health workforce crisis and has not tried to improve it, the impact on other health services seems to be negative. Now, what we found also is that this does not depend, it doesn't seem to depend that much on the attitude of donors. Global Fund and PEPFAR are willing to fund the health workforce. And it was interesting to see in the meeting that some people explained what they were doing with Global Fund money to strengthen the health workforce. And then people from other countries said, oh, but we didn't know that we could use Global Fund grants for this. And so sharing information about what is possible would be a first step to solve this. Now, the way forward. The global AIDS response has created a renewed momentum for what is fundamentally a shared and uniting paradigm of comprehensive primary health care, which includes AIDS prevention and treatment. So no more selective primary health care. This is really a paradigm or an intention that can bring those two tribes together. There are lessons to be learned from the fight against AIDS that can and should be applied in the fight for comprehensive primary health care. And I listed just a few of the most important that came out of our discussions, really acknowledging that health is a human right and health care is an entitlement, that programming and financing of health care should be adapted to needs, to real needs, and not to the alleged scarcity of resources. Concerns about sustainability of health care, not only AIDS treatment, should be considered at a global level, not only at a national level. Macroeconomic policies by the IMF and to some extent also by the World Bank must be adjusted to vital needs and not the other way around. And last but not least, people have a right and a duty to be involved in all decisions about their health. The way forward. I mean, we are living in a world where the average economic product is about 7,500 per inhabitant of this planet. So the global economy could easily afford to spend $300 per person per year on healthcare. That's only 4% of the GDP, and most rich countries are spending a lot more. Yet, in this world, in some countries, the government health budget is still less than $15 per person per year. The difference is huge, and somehow the fight against AIDS created some kind of Copernican revolution in health economy by saying that, yes, AIDS treatment might be too expensive for national economies, but it surely is not too expensive for the global economy. Now, this is a new perspective on sustainability, on financing, on health economy, and if we can use this new perspective for comprehensive primary health care, perhaps 30 years after Alma-Ata, we can realize it. Now, the way backward, I just wanted to put in a very recent quote from a discussion in Mozambique about health sector salary reform, where donors say, yes, sustainability is an important issue in the sense that in the longer run, the national economy should be able to pay for increased levels of salaries. Why should it be the national economy? Why can't we rely on national and international funding? If health is a human right, if we're serious about it, then there's a duty for all human beings and all countries to contribute to it and to help the poor countries. And this is really a new way of looking at health economy. So some recommendations might seem obvious, but again, governments must live up to their promises. There's a very old promise by rich countries to spend 0.7% of their GDP to international solidarity. Well, if they would do that, and if they would spend 15% of that to international solidarity in health, we would have $37 billion per year, which is much more than what we have today. It's an old promise, but it's about time that it's fulfilled. Now, it's not only the governments of high-income countries, also the governments of middle-income countries and low-income countries must live up to their promise. They promised in Abuja a couple of years ago to allocate 15% of government revenue to health expenditure. Well, they have to do that, and let's hope they won't need three decades like rich countries are needing, and we're still not there. So as a conclusion, comprehensive primary health care for all is possible. It can include universal access to AIDS prevention and treatment, even in the poorest countries, within this new paradigm created by the fight against AIDS. And when two tribes go to war together rather than against each other, it is possible. Now, I was planning to sing this like Peter Piot sung Bob Marley, but I'm not going to do that. Thank you.
Gore, we'll get you to do it before the end of the session. That was great. Visionary thoughts about how we might make this work. Now, let's go down the panel. Carissa Etienne, is a relatively new assistant director general at WHO, and she's been given the hot job of fixing this issue around health systems. And she's already started with incredible energy to make WHO make a big difference. So it's a real pleasure to introduce Carissa to give some thoughts and reflections after hearing Gorik. Carissa, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Richard, for this introduction. I'm going to use my 5 minutes strategically, so I'm going to speak about health systems and the future as it is envisioned. Certainly, WHO is seized of the fact that weak health systems are limiting the progress to the outcomes that could be achieved by disease-specific programs. We concentrate on meeting the Millennium Development Goals, and even as we are aware that we are not on track in many countries to meet these MDGs, we also recognize that the HIV/AIDS epidemic is also having a negative impact on our ability to meet the other MDGs, and particularly the health-related MDGs. We recognize that there is growing consensus that several aspects of health systems are in fact responsible for significant limitations in terms of the health outcomes. So what it is when we speak of our health system, how could we define it, and what are we speaking about? And there is a WHO definition of 2000 that has been adjusted to read all organizations, people, and actions whose primary intent is to promote, restore, or maintain health. And this is what we refer to when we speak of a health system. And it is sometimes useful to think of the health system as consisting of 6 building blocks that are interrelated and interlinked, but very importantly, that people are at the very center of those. And these blocks are health workers, financing, medical products and vaccines and technology, service delivery, health information, leadership and governance. It is clear that health systems must deliver on some very important functions. A health system must deliver services to a whole population, so the emphasis on universal coverage and universal access. A health system should provide clients with services to meet clients' needs and expectations. Comprehensive care that is oriented around clients' needs and expectations. A health system must deliver services in a way that is equitable and must address the needs of the poor, vulnerable, and marginalized. The question of equity. And a health system must deliver services of good quality. And a health system must be robust enough to respond to existing needs, but also to complex and emerging challenges. And we have had a series of meetings with regional consultations, and indeed the emerging vision for health system strengthening is that health system strengthening must be based on primary health care. That indeed the core values and principles, as they were espoused in Alma Ata, the principles of equity, social justice, or human rights, and solidarity, are all relevant today as they were 30 years ago. And this must be form the underpinning of the organization of health systems and strengthening, health system strengthening. And what we are seeing is the emergence of 4 sorts of reforms within the health system strengthening. A reform that speaks to universal access, that speaks to health for all, that speaks to reaching the unreached, and to achieve this level of access, obviously, the attention to social protection in terms of risk pooling and prepayment schemes. But we need to make the point that primary health care is not just for poor countries, that it is relevant for the rich, for middle-income and low-income countries. And indeed, if we are to achieve this, then we must undergo a primary care reforms as well. And primary care that is not necessarily the first level of care, but it's care that is organized around the patient's needs and expectations, care that is comprehensive, integrated, that seeks to address continuity of care and high quality. But indeed, where the client, the patient, his family and his community are at the very center of that organization of care, but must also be an equal participant in the decision-making process about their care. And so we also begin to see that there is a need for public policy reforms, reforms that speak to the social determinants of health and seek to incorporate the all-of-government approach and also the participation of all sectors in ensuring health and well-being. And then, of course, this needs a level of leadership and governance that will call for a degree of reform as well, a leadership that is open to inclusiveness, to sitting around the table with private sector and civil society organization, a leadership that is open to greater transparency and accountability, and you will utilize evidence for decision making. And certainly, my 5 minutes is almost up, so I want to say, we'll have time to talk about positive synergies and what we are doing, but I want to say that we must never forget the big picture. You think I'm young, I am not. I have been in this work for a long time, almost 30 years, and I have watched the pendulum swing from health system strengthening to disease-specific program. And it seems that we want to swing it again to health systems. We must learn from our errors of the past. It's not either or. We must pay attention to both, to strengthening health systems and improving and investing in disease-specific programs. I think we have an opportunity now, and I think that we need to get it right for ourselves, but also for the children of this world. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Carissa. Now, UNAIDS has re-embraced this message as part of its core program of work. And we've seen that all week, this week. It's been a vital protagonist in the debate between vertical and horizontal, and I know that Peter Piot has been very much involved in those discussions. Slightly anxious, I know he's been, about the use of the word diagonal and perhaps the dangers of drawing resources away from HIV/AIDS and an exceptional response to HIV/AIDS, which might be diluted by a focus on health systems. And getting this balance right is very difficult. So we're very fortunate today to have Prasada Rao from UNAIDS to give us a steer about UNAIDS's views about how we might guide ourselves in the future. Prasada, you're welcome.
Thank you, Richard, for the introduction and for giving me this opportunity. I also thank Gorik for those observations in his presentation, which are very much evidence-based, and much of it will support what I am going to say in the next few minutes. I have been involved with HIV/AIDS in three different capacities during the last 12 years. First, as the program director of the India's national program, then as the permanent secretary of health in the government of India, where I had opportunity to look at the entire health sector, and now as the UNAIDS representative in a relatively less prioritized region like Asia and the Pacific. So my observations will be based on the understanding these three perspectives have given me. I do not see, and I agree with Carissa, this as a debate between AIDS and health system. It is not one against the other. But much of this debate on AIDS versus health systems must have arisen mostly because of the experience in some generalized epidemic countries and mostly of sub-Saharan Africa. In the rest of the developing world, where the epidemic is low or concentrated, it is still a problem of inadequate resources flowing into AIDS programs due to low levels of political commitment. This is also true of health sector as a whole. So what are we talking? We are not talking about that these countries are not rolling in riches so far as AIDS programs are concerned, that they have enough to divert it somewhere else. It is now a largely established fact that AIDS has in fact, it had a pull effect on the health sector, which was otherwise languishing at the bottom of the ladder in terms of political priorities and investment priorities in many of these countries. AIDS has brought dynamism and activism in the development agenda. It opened dialogue on taboo subjects which mainstream society has pushed into a closet for centuries. AIDS has strengthened the concept of health as a public good and established the relationship between health, development and global security. The benefits therefore have far outweighed the losses in terms of resources, so-called diversion of resources, in much of the developing world. But how much of the, in generalized epidemic countries, the shortage of human resources for general health programs, etc., how much of that can be apportioned to AIDS is also a matter of debate. The reality today is that while the million to billion shift has occurred in AIDS spending, a disproportionately small amount of it has gone into prevention, into substantially reducing incidence, that is the new infections occurring still on a large scale in much of Asia, Central Europe and other regions. In other words, high impact prevention programs which address most at-risk populations, including men who pay for sex and their female partners, have still not received their due share of resources. It is also an acknowledged fact that the high level of stigma and discrimination prevent the vulnerable populations who are criminalized under national laws from accessing health systems, both for prevention and treatment programs. I am yet to see a day where men who have sex with men, injecting drug users and sex workers line up before a district hospital for antiretroviral treatment or for condoms. As the Commission on AIDS in Asia has recommended, it is only the community-owned and community-run programs which can effectively reach out to these populations. Evidence shows that if new infections still occurring through paid sex and drug use in much of the developing world are not substantially reduced in the next three to five years, many of the countries would be missing their universal access and the MDG targets. Diversion of resources from AIDS by raising the bogey of overfunding and questioning AIDS exceptionalism and even going to the extent of asking for dismemberment of the joint program on AIDS can prove disastrous to scaling up of prevention and treatment programs at this critical stage of global response. Instead, I would advocate for a more prudent approach of building on the success of AIDS movement to attract larger resources for the health system development. We need to take a re-look at the way we think about health systems. We need to examine the human and social aspects of the health system rather than focusing only on infrastructure and logistics, which is the commonly understood viewpoint. AIDS has also shown the way on how to secure private sector and civil society participation in health sector programs, how to secure community involvement, how to establish a base for wider social sector reforms in areas which go even beyond health sector, like women inheritance rights, decriminalization of sex work, gender-based violence, violation of human rights, etc. Overall, health sector has many lessons to learn from the way AIDS-related issues have been projected with solid evidence before national governments of developing countries for gaining political support and attracting larger resources. Finally, AIDS has provided a historical opportunity to project health as a priority for human development. The answer, therefore, is not to divert resources from AIDS programs, but for generating activism around health sector as a whole by building a strong evidence base to project the interminable link between health and human development and help countries garner larger resources for health sector, both domestic as well as external. The message is we should try to raise the bar for total health spending, which in many developing countries is hovering around 1% for the last several decades. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Prasada. Now, when you look at why it is that the AIDS movement has been so successful in generating resources and doing the things that we've heard it has succeeded in doing, the absolute quintessential part of that success has been the leadership from NGO and civil society movements. And our next two speakers are going to reflect that and give their perspective on how this emerging discussion is evolving. First, then, please welcome Eileen Stillwagon from the International AIDS Economic Network. Eileen.
Thank you, Richard. I'll save some time and say I agree with that, all of that. Okay, but here's another message. As an economist, it's my job to bring you the good news that integrating HIV prevention and treatment into primary health care makes economic sense. because it takes advantage of the biological synergies among diseases and utilizes economies of scale and scope. Although vertical programs have sometimes been very successful, that has not generally been the case for HIV programs, at least in poor populations. AIDS exceptionalism has even distorted HIV research, prevention, and treatment. AIDS did not arise in a vacuum. The worst HIV epidemics are found in countries with multiple endemic diseases that increase vulnerability to HIV and increase contagiousness of HIV-infected people in sexual or vertical transmission. For example, we know that malaria increases viral load as much as tenfold, increasing sexual and vertical transmission for several weeks after febrile episodes. Preventing HIV in malaria endemic populations requires that we also prevent malaria. Even effective treatment of HIV will require an integrated approach. A forthcoming article in AIDS reports on a double-blind, placebo-controlled study demonstrating that CD4 counts can be increased in HIV-infected persons co-infected with Ascaris by giving them deworming medication that costs about 2 US cents. Thus, it may be possible to postpone first-line antiretroviral therapy in these persons for a considerable length of time, protecting them and preserving first- and second-line therapies. A third example of a common disease that interacts with HIV is urinary schistosomiasis, which affects over 200 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. Genital lesions of schistosomiasis increase sexual transmission of HIV in women threefold, but that additional risk could be eliminated for 10 U.S. cents per year. Moreover, people infected with schistosomiasis often cannot tolerate antiretroviral therapy because the parasite impairs liver function. Just as TB treatment precedes ART, deworming should be part of the ART protocol. Trying to roll out ART without treating widespread, easily curable conditions like worms wastes lives and squanders first-line therapy. How did we get to this place where conditions as widespread as malaria, worms, and malnutrition, and remedies as obvious as basic health care have been ignored? The fault lies in both the biomedical fields and in the social sciences for evaluating diseases and interventions isolated from their context. Cost-effectiveness analysis usually looks at single inputs and single outputs and is best suited to comparing similar interventions. It can identify only local maxima or minima. But the landscape of HIV transmission is very complex. If we only want to advise policymakers whether it's better to hand out condoms with or without lollipops, or, let's be fair, in a factory or a community center, the current methods are adequate. But it's not much help if the larger reason that HIV spreads so rapidly, sexually and vertically, in poor populations, is the high prevalence of malaria, schistosomiasis, or filariasis. In that case, cost-effectiveness analysis gives us very precise, even correct, answers to the wrong questions. We need new economic tools if we can't see that. Trying to solve one health problem at a time is doing things the hard way. It throws away the many opportunities to solve multiple problems simultaneously and using lower-cost, higher-impact, readily available options. In response to calls for broad-based health spending, Dr. Jim Kim has been quoted as challenging, "What would you do with the money next week?" This is not rocket science. We know how to make people healthier and less vulnerable to infectious diseases. In 2006, the World Health Organization established the protocols for integrated treatment of multiple tropical diseases, capturing tremendous economies of scope. And pharmaceutical companies have committed themselves to contributing, free of charge for as long as it takes, the drugs needed to eliminate many of the diseases that interact with HIV. PEPFAR and other donors just need to accept that offer to integrate treatment of HIV and cofactor diseases. AIDS is very important, and that is why I've dedicated the last 10 years to HIV and its co-infections. But we can achieve our goal of healthy individuals in healthy populations only if we stop chasing after one virus, one person at a time. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Eileen. Our next speaker, please welcome Aditi Sharma. Aditi is the International AIDS Policy and Campaign Coordinator for ActionAid, and she also represents the International Treatment Preparedness Coalition. Aditi.
Thanks. This debate has been declared sterile, outdated, unnecessary at this conference by health activists, AIDS activists, and health ministers alike. So why do we need this debate? I think this debate is important because it is not just being held by academics. The danger of this debate is that it is being used as a shroud to cover up a litany of broken promises by the donor governments, by the G8 and other donor governments. First on aid, Gorik mentioned the 0.7 target. Then on Africa, we were going to double aid to Africa. And most importantly in this context, on HIV/AIDS. Just a few years ago, we were promised universal access to HIV/AIDS services by 2010. And all of you sitting here know where we are at. So while the donor community is busy promoting new health initiatives, creating and setting up new partnerships, they are shortchanging even existing initiatives like the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and they're not promising new funds for health system strengthening. So these initiatives come cheap. Among the donors, AIDS is no longer in fashion. Health systems is in, as we know for the G8 summits in Japan and Germany before. But for HIV-positive women in India, and you see daily reports of this, who go from hospital to hospital and are refused treatment, who are refused the provision to deliver their baby in hospital, these debates are a matter of life and death. And that's why we need to continue to have them. So I want to talk about, let us move forward. So what does a strong health system look like? We're talking about strengthening health systems. What does it look like? As Prasada Rao said, in how many countries does the health system really deliver health care equally? Equally to women and children, equally to prisoners, to drug users, equally to sex workers, to gay men, equally to migrants, to refugees. So, and were it not for activists like us shouting from the rooftops, would we even bother to check? Health care is political. It is social. It is cultural. Just providing or ensuring funding and building more primary healthcare centers does not equal access. It does not equal access for rural women in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. Deep-rooted patriarchy, gender inequality, violence against women will stand in the way of healthcare access. Good AIDS programs recognize this. So let us build on this. We cannot afford to lose this and go back and revert back to old-style public health strategies. Feminists in this room, and there are many, will remind us of their struggle and the dangers of old-style public health strategies. Remember family planning, which meant forced sterilization and toxic therapies for thousands of women. We cannot afford to go back there. So yes, let us step up together the campaign for universal access to health care for all, but let us name all. For a woman to enjoy her right to health requires more primary health care centers near her so she doesn't have to travel far. It does require nurses who are there in those primary health care centers. We need to hire them, we need to retain them, we need to pay them a living wage. But it also requires that the health care system identifies and tackles signs of gender violence. It also requires that that healthcare system prioritizes sexual and reproductive health. It also requires that PMTCT programs
that offer her treatment for her lifetime, not just to help her deliver that baby. Finally, I'd like to talk about this issue about AIDS distorting, or what are the benefits of the AIDS response on health systems. I disagree that AIDS has distorted, the AIDS response has distorted health systems. While the AIDS epidemic has certainly exposed the chronic underfunding in health systems and the fragility of health systems in all our countries, ITPC's six-country research recently launched reveals many positive impacts of the scale-up of HIV services in healthcare. A colleague of mine has copies of the research if you're interested back there. Let me tell you about the four key benefits. We did research in six countries, and we found generally the AIDS response has meant a building up of infrastructure and systems. It has raised the bar on quality of healthcare. Most importantly, it has, as I said before, it has extended the reach of healthcare to socially marginalized groups. And it has engaged healthcare consumers in planning and delivering of services. And as Gaurav said earlier, this is critical. So let me end with three examples from the report. In Zimbabwe, HIV/AIDS services, particularly the provisions of ARVs, have become a lifeline in the virtually collapsed health delivery system. I don't need to explain anymore. In Uganda, safe water programs for people living with HIV/AIDS have benefited whole communities. This is also strengthening a healthcare system. Medical personnel, clinics that have been funded by HIV programs aren't just there to treat HIV/AIDS. They're there to treat other diseases. In Argentina, HIV strategies have improved access to health for stigmatized populations, specifically for drug users, sex workers, transgenders, and migrants. So these are real examples. This is evidence on the ground. So as ITPC, we believe that the global mobilization on AIDS has not diverted resources, but greatly expanded total health funding. The AIDS movement has opened up a sense of possibility of change, the progress in providing healthcare to all who need it. This was what Almaty is all about. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Aditi. Now, if we're going to make this vision a reality, we have to have the support of those major funding agencies, PEPFAR, the World Bank, and the Global Fund, to really back this vision of a comprehensive primary health care strategy. And we're very fortunate today to have Daniel Lobier with us. Daniel will be well known to many of you as the Director of Performance and Effectiveness at the Global Fund. Daniel, please come and tell us the fund's view.
Thank you, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be part of this discussion. I want to make two main points. First of all, we very much subscribe, and I want to say this loudly, to the two-tribe approach. Funding AIDS, but also funding the necessary health systems and doing this together. I want to show you a little bit that flexibility and explain how that can be done in our programs. Second point, the comment whether AIDS treatment kills people. I want to share some of the increasing evidence that to strengthen health systems it is necessary to have strong disease control programs, both for healthy human resources for health and because the large burden on health systems in Africa are the cases of AIDS and the cases of malaria. The final point I want to put up for question is we need to think through the systems that deliver prevention. This goes beyond a little bit delivering services to the quality of engagement with communities and very much the NGO and the community networks that are essential for this quality engagement to people at risk. So first of all, Global Fund role in health systems. I want to say very strongly that we fund AIDS and we fund the necessary health systems actions. And we would like grants to include that in their proposals. We focus on results for AIDS, TB and malaria. But we allow countries to decide how best to achieve them. And if UNAIDS mentions that the bottlenecks are health systems, these should be included. So if a country needs to train, it needs to invest in procurement, M&E, supply systems, there is the flexibility in this funding. And I'll give you three examples to illustrate that in our, on our portfolio. First of all, the Ethiopia AIDS program. Initially, it funded AIDS workers in communities to provide AIDS services. Very soon in the grant, it was found that people didn't want to visit an AIDS worker in their communities. So we moved funding to support 30,000 health workers in communities who provide AIDS, TB, malaria, and other health services. Second example is Malawi, delivering a very ambitious AIDS treatment program, very poor health setting. After 18 months when we reviewed this in our performance system, it was clear the bottleneck was human resources for health. And we moved $40 million from the program into the general human resources for health strategy of the government. Alongside other donors, DFID made a very large contribution. And this was necessary for the performance of the grant. Third example is our Rwanda AIDS grants, where we support health workers and also refurbishment of some of the worst hospitals in Rwanda. And the outcomes have been increasing AIDS treatment together with TB and malaria, but also health visits for all health conditions have doubled in these hospitals. Certainly more needs to be done in our portfolio, and these are some of the best examples, but we certainly say very strongly to programs to include this flexibility to fund AIDS and to fund the necessary health systems. So we've become a major funder. We estimate 35% of our funding is in health systems, and we've also brought in increasing flexibility over time. In 2007, we've introduced the ability to fund strategic health systems actions that go beyond a single disease. $360 million was agreed to this in 2007. So countries should include these actions in their proposals, and if bottlenecks occur in grants, reprogram funds to try and improve their performance. We need the two triads vision, the double vision of AIDS and health systems. They can be included in the proposals, AIDS, TB and malaria strengthening actions, or as a separate annex for more general measures beyond the single disease. It should be done in the context of national disease and health plans. But clearly, the financial needs go beyond what can just be provided by the global fund, so we also ask countries to use other funding. We realize this is a new approach, which is why I am also mentioning it very loudly to try and include in our grants, AIDS, and health systems, and it hasn't been fully and evenly introduced in our grants. The second point is I think there's increasing evidence that strong disease control programs are necessary to strengthen health systems, particularly in the high-burden countries in Africa. First of all, healthy human resources for health. We need to ensure that more health workers don't die of AIDS than we can train in a year. And I think the numbers here are critical and becoming quite clear. In Malawi, to deliver the HIV treatment program, it requires 250 health workers, which is certainly a major effort. But there's also over 1,000 health workers on ARV treatment who would have died without the AIDS program. So it is beginning to be clear that the return in terms of human resources for health is positive, and many times for many of these AIDS programs. And then second, we need to recognize the huge disease burden on African health systems. Having worked in both in South Africa in the gastroenterology or the psychiatry department, you find 50% of cases are AIDS-related. And outpatients, clearly malaria is a major issue. And to tackle this disease burden, which has overwhelmed African health systems, it is essential if we're going to strengthen them to have strong disease programs. And I'm just going to now give you an example from the Ministry of Health in Botswana, and this is not occurring in many countries, but where we have had successful disease programs, the effect it can have on health systems. She quotes, "You go to the medical ward, and now half of the beds are not occupied. Before they were mushrooming. A manager came to me as Minister of Health and said, 'You're bad for business. Our funeral business is going down.'" In Tanzania, for the first time in a decade, doctors are saying hospitals can become hospitals again with AIDS treatment. So we clearly need to think of strong disease programs alongside health system strengthening, be this for health conditions like obesity in the United States or AIDS in malaria. We need to ensure we have programs in place to deal with the disease causes as well as the strong health systems actions. And then my final point is we need to think through carefully the systems needed to deliver prevention and the type of health outcomes of declining prevalence, behavior changes we have seen in a few countries. And these systems may look very different. They certainly have a strong NGO and community engagement into communities, engaging with communications, with behaviors. AIDS surveillance and mortality has been important at local level, and that the political system extends debates on AIDS down into these communities. They've often occurred in some of the poorest situations and with some of the weakest health systems, and we need to ensure that these systems for prevention are also built. So in conclusion, I need to say very loudly the Global Fund funds AIDS and also the necessary strengthening health systems measures. If grants have problems in these issues, talk to their fund portfolio manager, talk to myself, because we need to ensure this is more strongly built into our programs. As our funding increases 2 to 3 times over the coming years, we would like to see the health systems components increasing at least at that level. Second, we need the two tribes approach. We need strong disease programs alongside health systems if we are going to reduce the burden on health systems in certainly in Africa. And then finally, more for discussion, we need to think through the systems for prevention, and this is, involves a very strong role for community and NGO groups and strengthening. Thank you very much.
And Daniel promised me that he'd give you his email address at the end so you can contact him directly to appeal those grants that might just get turned down from time to time. Our next speaker is Francisco Songane. Francisco will be well known to those of you in the maternal, newborn and child health communities in particular. He's a former Minister of Health in Mozambique, and most importantly now he is Director of the Partnership on Maternal, Newborn and Child Health based in Geneva. His work in this area has been critical in identifying health systems as a major obstacle to advancing the health of women and children, and we're very pleased to have him with us this afternoon to give his observations on this critical issue. Francisco.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard, and the other colleagues on the panel. I should like to start by thanking the organizers for setting this session. It's a very important one. It is hitting the core of the problem when we deal with what the countries face. HIV, in fact, was a wake-up call. I'm starting by saying this to address this issue whether HIV programs are taking money from the health systems or not. When the epidemic began to take its toll, we were all scared because it was revealing that most of the countries were not prepared to deal with such a problem. That was a wake-up call. So we learned from that. We are still learning from that. So it's better that we build from what we learned so far and see how we can improve our approaches together with other players who are addressing other health problems. This is just one issue. If we are addressing malaria, maternal health, and other health problems, we'll end up talking about health systems. That is the core. We are 30 years now from the proclamation of Alma-Ata on primary health care. And we're realizing that somehow we failed that proclamation that we should be comprehensive, to be holistic, getting the collaborative aspects between the different departments and institutions, and see health as a whole, not just as a separate program particularly. I think this is the context we should get our discussion going in addressing the health systems. That how we build on the synergies of different programs like the program is tackling HIV and AIDS and reinforce the health systems within the perspective of the primary health care and the holistic approach of it. I would like to propose one approach. There are several. To take women and children, one important link we can address, prevention of mother-to-child transmission. If we assess how we are doing in terms of maternal care, we realize that in the countries where the burden is highest in this regard, 80% of the pregnant women get at least one contact with the health services or with the health provider to go for the antenatal clinic. When it comes to delivery, only half of the women are getting skilled care attendance at delivery. So we lose considerable number of pregnant women. That could be a very good entry point. If we want to address PMTCT, we could start from the first contact that pregnant woman makes with the health system or the health provider, and build throughout until she delivers with the proper care, and we care after the newborn and herself afterwards. Gorick and other speakers said it very well. That's not just to treat the PMTCT as a way of preventing the transmission of HIV to the child. Is to look at the woman as a human being. She has got her own needs, that after the delivery, whatever needs she has to be taken care of. If we don't have a very good working system to be comprehensive and to look at this comprehensive approach, we cannot succeed and be humane in our treatment. This is the very important human rights approach we have to take into consideration. We have made progress in terms of the prevention of transmission of HIV from mother to child. From 10% to 23% in 2005. But most of the women are not having those services. That could be our challenge. What we need to do together, people addressing maternal and child health issues, people addressing HIV, AIDS, and other problems, how we can work together to see where are the bottlenecks, where are the obstacles, address them in order to reach those women who are not reaching. In terms of the newborns, 1 in 10 are getting the treatment in terms of ARVs, and the other 9 are not having. Prophylaxis, using basic antibiotics, only 1 in 20 children are getting those services. Not surprising. When we assess how well we are doing in terms of the provision of clinical services to tackle children's problem, we realize that we are treating less than half of children who have got diarrhea. We're treating one-third of the children who have got pneumonia, one of the major killers amongst children. Because of what? We are not able to respond. Our systems are weak. Let us take this part where we can get the synergies between the two groups and build the system. Another element I would like to address is the synergies between the different initiatives. One colleague was saying, many partnerships, many initiatives, many reinvented initiatives, that's true. They're complex, it's overcrowding, it's confusing somehow for the countries. They don't know where to look at, which direction to follow. My proposition is, let us make all these things play at the country level. Be an initiative on HIV, on malaria, on maternal health, on any other problem. The way we should express it is at the country level. We reflect this at the country plan under the leadership of the government, and we work together. And that banner will be how well we're doing to tackle the country's problem, how well we're doing to address the country plan, which would have all these elements together. And there are many resources from the different initiatives and partnerships, those partnerships and initiatives able to fund. If we would reflect this to address the country plan, we would have to make much more strides than what we are doing now. And the last element I would like to bring is the issue of solidarity. We are all discussing whether AIDS is taking money from the health systems, whether malaria is taking money from the health system, whether we're addressing this or not, because of one reason. Investments in health are not enough. Be what the countries are doing domestically, be what the international community is doing as international solidarity. If we recall what was proposed on the report on macroeconomics and health, is that we would need a per capita for health of around $40 to address the basic problems which are afflicting most of the people in these many countries. What the countries are having to live with is between $5, $9, up to $12 per capita in most of the countries. And of this contribution, 60% or more is external money. So we need to invest at the dimension of the challenge, not piecemeal, bits here and there. We should not wait to respond to activism alone. This human rights approach should compel on all of us, be domestically, be international community, that we have got a moral duty to face the problems we are facing today in terms of the health and invest accordingly. Because one thing is certain, is not shortage of money. If it was shortage of money, we'd not be starting major challenges which are bringing destructions and costing 10, 15, maybe 20 times more what we are asking for to tackle the basic problems. The international solidarity with a big S is what is called for, and balanced by the right approach, political leadership, and drive from the countries, and get this to meet midway and really tackle the problems. That possibility is there. That is my proposition. Thank you.
I think Mozambique's losses are gain, Francisco. Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very pleased that our final speaker was able to be with us this afternoon. Rilake Odetuyinbo is going to speak on behalf of Positive Action for Treatment Access. So please welcome Rilake.
Good afternoon. That's not fair. Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Rilake Odetuyinbo, and today we are talking about strengthening health systems through the AIDS response. Specifically, I'm looking at the role of GEPA in strengthening health systems. And to do this, we need to ask ourselves exactly what is GEPA. I think we need to remind ourselves really what does this mean. We've had different definitions, and some of us, it's MIPA, it's GEPA, it's SIPA. You know, we've just totally asked ourselves what really. So we should go back to the basics and say, really, when we say GEPA, what do we mean? This, we know, was something that a declaration that came out of the Paris Summit, and it's the International AIDS Summit in Paris in 1994. And it's talking about the role, greater involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS in people living with HIV and AIDS. Now, we've gone further, and what we're saying is, GEPA really, is it just about people living with HIV? Is that the only opportunity we have? 10 years ago, when I tested HIV positive, my greatest source of strength were my parents, my family. So, whatever it is, as a person living with HIV, those who are directly affected really do need the support. Which is why GEPA today, we're saying GEPA means greater involvement in people living with HIV and people directly affected by HIV. And this means our spouses, our parents, and our children. What then should be the role of GEPA, looking at this untapped great resource we have? What should be the role of GEPA in strengthening health systems? If you go back and look at the GEPA, there is a document that's been produced by ICASO, by GNP Plus, and it's looking at monitoring GEPA. And if you look down, you have different roles that people living with HIV can play. And the question is, what then is our current role? Right now, a lot of us are patients and service recipients. We are volunteer counselors, and somehow it's like we are really stuck in that role of volunteers. That's the only thing we are destined to be. We have worked tirelessly, we've made great impact as volunteers, so, and it's an unpaid position. Suddenly, there is a partner who's willing to support and fund that position, and then we are suddenly never good enough. You know, we need to have the 5 credits, we need to have all these school sets and all the qualifications you need to get that role, forgetting that this volunteer has played that role effectively for the past 4 or 5 years. When it suddenly becomes a paid position, then we have to remember that there's a criteria to employ in civil service, and you go back to what are your basic qualifications educationally. We have also become images on leaflets. So, I mean, it's good to have a face of a person living with HIV, and that's really all. To some people, that's what GEPA is, just put the faces there. Also, we have become testimonial to whip up sentiment. So we have our children on these beautiful posters talking about what is happening with PMTCT, and you have our faces all over the place, and it helps whip up sentiments, and it also helps get the money in, really, because when you see those faces and those pictures, then it means that there is a great problem and we need to send the money there. Also, we have also become spokesperson for behavioral change. I have been invited to a church to come talk to young women on HIV and AIDS, and the pastor's wife wanted me to talk about use of condom and abstinence. Ultimately, what she was telling me is she wanted me to come say to the young people, if you have sex before marriage, you will end up like me. That was really the message, because she wanted the person living with HIV to come talk about, but she said, we don't talk condoms, we don't talk all of that, just abstain and be faithful. But she wanted the person living with HIV to do that. What message was I supposed to be passing? So ultimately, the question we're asking ourselves is, what then should be our role? We should, right now, what are the roles that we are playing? We are advocates, and I'm sure everybody in this room will agree to that. But for people living with HIV and directly affected by HIV, we probably would have moved. The movement and what we would have achieved today would be actually very, very little. We are also watchdogs in our various countries. And I'm excited and I feel highly honored when I'm called an activist, because it means certainly you are doing something. And those are the roles we are having as watchdogs. Also, we are program managers. We're involved in planning, designing, monitoring, and evaluation. And we participate in decision-making bodies, but to what level and where? Where exactly does this happen? It happens at all the global levels, but in country, apart from very few countries like Mexico, where else do you have people living with HIV participating at the highest level? For GEPA to become meaningful, for GEPA to make an impact in healthcare spending, we have to go back again. I just learned this, and to me, it's my mantra. And if you leave this AIDS conference with nothing, please let's learn that what we're asking is that GEPA should go from greater involvement to greater investment. You need to invest in people living with HIV to get the meaningful involvement you want. So we need to bridge the gap between greater involvement and people living with HIV. Also, stigma and discrimination must be addressed. We need to have us involved in our existing capacities. So if you're going to talk, if you're looking for somebody to manage a program, look at the totality of my human being. Before HIV, I was someone. I did something. I had a life. Do not just put me in the HIV box and that's the only role I'm supposed to play, forgetting that I have other existing capacity. And that is one of the reasons why I think we really are losing out on these untapped resources. People who did great things before HIV came into their life, and let's move them out of this PLHIV box and move on to other things. Finally, we must create an enabling environment for our professionals who are infected. Doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, who are living with HIV have it extremely tough, because on all fronts it's like a no-win situation. The healthcare, the patient says no, the hospital says no. It's just appalling. We need to find places and we need to find a way to bridge the gap and make sure that this untapped resource really, really is effective. Thank you very much.
Okay, now, we're going to have some discussion, because you've heard a lot of views there, and there are some similarities, a few little differences, and I'm sure you've all got your own thoughts as well. So I'm going to kick off with a question for Carissa, and then we'll see how others want to respond to that. We all remember Alma Ata. Well, may not remember it as a reality 30 years ago, but there it was, 30 years ago. And we're going to celebrate the anniversary September and October this year. And it was a fantastic, compelling vision, just like the compelling vision that Gorick laid out for us. But it didn't work. What are the lessons that we have to learn from that incredible vision of Alma Ata 30 years ago, which stumbled almost immediately after it was born? How are we not going to make that same mistake now? Carissa, and then anybody on the panel who wants to come in. And all of you out there, think of some questions, because I'm going to ask you for some contributions in a minute.
Thank you, Richard. Alma Ata 30 years ago was also a developmental approach. And that is the big part of Alma Ata that was forgotten. Very, very soon after Alma Ata, it was relegated to selective primary health care and first level care. And we completely forgot that it was about human development within the broader developmental agenda. And I think that's one of the things that we need to learn from and not make the same mistake. Very often I hear people say it did not work. And the question I ask, what is it? Because the it that was implemented was not what was described within Alma Ata. And so we have evidence of countries that pursued with the goal of universal access, and these countries can now demonstrate that their health systems are better placed to respond to emerging epidemics and to chronic conditions. So we have to be careful when we say that it does not work. What are the lessons of the past that we can learn from the past? Certainly the lessons that our ultimate goal must always be upholding the health and well-being and dignity of human beings. If we stray from this ultimate goal, then we accept arguments that say we can't afford to ensure comprehensive care for all individuals. And once we accept those, then we begin to go into selective care process, disease-specific programs that are not related to people's needs and to their human development needs. I think we have to be careful as well that the whole debate on health systems and delivering on universal access does not remain a Ministry of Health agenda. That indeed it must transcend and include an all-of-government approach, and certainly involve the international community, but very importantly, that community participation in decision making, and now as it is also represented in strengthened civil society organizations, must be important, because they must play the watchdog role. And we must also guard against the international organizations that continue to define policies that are contrary to the health and well-being of all individuals. And this, I will stop here.
Very good. Francisco, as a minister in Mozambique, you weren't a minister 30 years ago in Mozambique, but you will remember, I'm sure, and as a minister grappled with some of the principles from Alma Ata as you were an important political steward of the health system. What lessons do we need to learn from that as we revision things today?
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Well, I was born into the primary health care. I graduated, I went directly into that. That was, I was graduated as a medical doctor. I was placed as a district medical officer at the beginning of the primary health care. I think leadership from the country is critical. Leadership from the international institutions, particularly the institutions with the mandate to steer the process, is paramount. If we don't get those things working together, there is no way we can progress. In the case of Mozambique, it was a success of applying Alma Ata principles, and in the 80s was quoted by WHO and the UNICEF as one of the examples in Africa where the primary health care worked. We're having a very good coverage of immunization. We're expanding the primary health services with addressing the equity situations. And the spirit in which people were trained was the spirit of Alma Ata. You were a nurse, a doctor, a pharmacist. You were taught when you started to work, you were involved in the processes of discussing the program implementation, policy setting. You will grow with this spirit of Alma Ata. No wonder why Mozambique, even after ravaging a 16-year-old war, destroying everything, we managed to come out of it quickly. And now we're at a good platform to rebuild the system, to try to match what we had in the 80s because of the spirit, the approach which was taken in the training of the people. This is critical. Leadership locally and internationally. Another element I would like to bring is that we have to stop searching for results tomorrow. One of the things that distorts is looking for results tomorrow. You invest today, you want the results next year. That doesn't work like that. You need reasonable time to see the results. And the other element linked to it is the different players, the different stakeholders, they wanted to say, this happens because of institution A, because of institution B. This happens because of the country together with the players. This is the mind shift we have to get, that when we are in a field, in a country, we have to embrace the country and our goals. Our glory is the glory of that country, no matter how many institutions we are in the field. I think these are critical elements.
Can I ask Aditi, because you gave some very good examples of how AIDS programs have strengthened health systems in the report you quoted. What added value could a comprehensive primary health care strategy give you when you look at the evidence from those country case studies in your report?
I think if we had a comprehensive primary and if we were moving to what Alma Ata was all about, we wouldn't need necessarily disease-specific funding. You know, if we had the systems in place, if we had invested in health workers, we wouldn't need to intervene. AIDS, as you said, was a wake-up call, and it exposed the lack of funding and the lack of investment in health systems. So, I mean, to me, there is still an opportunity because access to treatment has, I mean, many people on this panel have listed, you know, it has meant hospitals going back to being hospitals. So this is an opportunity for us to go back to comprehensive primary health care. And that people living with AIDS rely on primary health care and will rely more so on primary health care because they're living longer lives thanks to antiretrovirals. So you know, it is about a comprehensive primary health care.
Who else on the panel would like to come in on this question? Yes, Prasad.
When we look at Alma Ata, we should also look at the political situation in the world at that time. Mm-hmm. It was a time of democratic socialism, which was the ruling political philosophy in the world, and it was a nice thing to say that health for all, it's a nice word. But two basic deficiencies which have come in the wake of Alma Ata, one is there is absolutely no political commitment to that. It was just signing a declaration and everybody came back home and it was business as usual. Second is, there was no defining of resources. What is the type of resource base that is needed to secure that universal access? At no point of time there was any attempt to spell it out. So when we looked at our own country's policies at a later time, we find these two glaring deficiencies. And added to that, the third one is there is absolutely no monitoring. Look at on gas. Look at the way 2001 we had a session. In 5 years we came back and said, let's see what we are doing. There was no Almata 2. So it was just left to the countries. And some have done well, some have not done so well, and some have done very poorly. I think that is the basic problem with Almata.
Yes, Eileen and then Daniel.
I'd like to say, it seemed your question was, why did comprehensive primary health care fail? And I think it wasn't really tried. I'd like to emphasize that I think monitoring and evaluation are extremely important. It's our responsibility to spend our money wisely. It's not only the efficient thing to do, but it's also the compassionate thing to do to save as many lives. But we have to be really careful about what we're comparing when we do monitoring and evaluation. There was a very important cost-effectiveness study that was done in around 78 or 79, just after Alma-Ata, and just after the declaration of the water decade for the 1980s, when we were going to put clean water and sanitation in every village across the world, and that was going to be the theme for the 1980s. But simultaneously, there was one of the most important inventions or discoveries of the 20th century, oral rehydration therapy. It was absolutely a wonderful invention and has saved millions of infant lives. But there was a cost-effectiveness study of oral rehydration therapy that said that it was more cost-effective than sanitation or clean water. That kind of comparison was inappropriate because oral rehydration therapy saves infants from specific diarrheas. With clean water and sanitation, you're protecting the whole village from all kinds of waterborne diseases. That comparison should never have been made. Yes, we should have had oral rehydration therapy in the hands of every mother and father across the world, but we should not have stopped putting clean water and sanitation in all of those villages. If we can put it at, say, 4,000 meters, last week I was climbing in the Colorado Rockies, and there are actually latrines above 4,000 meters for hikers and climbers. If we can do it there with solar-powered decomposition systems, we can do it in villages.
Okay. Now, before Daniel answers, I'd like to invite, if you've got burning questions, please come up to the microphone, and then Daniel, go ahead.
Munyamani from Lesotho.
Hang on, let Daniel answer, and then we'll come to questions from the floor.
Okay.
Just briefly, I think there's two interesting movements in the last 25 to 30 years. One is the primary healthcare, but the other one is the AIDS movement. And many of the gaps you mentioned, political commitments, took a long time in AIDS, the resources, the monitoring, the involvement of people with communities. I think there's a lot can be learned by bringing those two together in a dual vision of healthcare, but it will always require strong disease programs as part of that.
Okay, now I want to invite you to come and I want you to keep your comments brief so we can get as many of them in as possible. I'm going to take a sequence before we have some responses from the panel. So please go.
Muluzi from Lesotho. It's very important for all of us to put our heads together to realize that health workers are an endangered species because they are trained and they are ignored. And this perpetuates their nomadic behavior, jumping from a health center to the program and from program to program and then overseas. While we are debating this, it's very important to help countries to be able to retain the trained people and also not to ignore the private sector because now it's deteriorating because when training is done of healthcare workers, the private sector is ignored.
Very good, thank you.
Ronnie Zachariah, Médecins Sans Frontières, Brussels. On behalf of nurses in sub-Saharan Africa, I want to make a comment and then I'd like to ask a question to the panel members. Today in Tiolo District in rural Malawi, where I worked and where we've achieved universal access, a nurse working in a health center keeps at least 400 patients alive, but she earns $3 US per day. When we ask donors, donors entrust her with up to $7,500 worth of drugs, HIV/AIDS drugs each month. And when we speak to donors about her conditions of service, they say it's not an option. Otherwise, some even say it's not their business. Nurses are the pillar of the health system in Africa. And if we're serious, ladies and gentlemen, if we're serious about universal action now, we need universal action now for our nurses. Please, please tell us, panel members, what exactly are you going to do to improve the conditions of our nurses? And please, please give us the courage to hold you accountable for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jenna Waters of the Children London. There are multiple dimensions for health system strengthening. One, or some, related to the provision of inputs, like money, human resources, drugs. And that's something that I would kind of take for granted, given that a health system is an entity characterized by joint production processes. But what about other dimensions of health system strengthening? I'm referring to improving leadership or governance or accountability. Dr. Songane highlighted the importance of national leadership that underpin all success stories in a health system reform. Are AIDS programs and in particular global health initiatives making a useful contribution also in that respect, or by being relatively or very successful, are they providing an excuse for governments to shy away from their primary responsibilities? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Hi, I represent an AIDS service organization called ASAP, serving South Asians in Toronto, Canada, and I commend Aditi for her presentation. I recently visited India as part of a stigma study, and I was appalled by the lack of human rights, lack of healthcare access to some villages in India that are just a few hours' drive from the global city of Mumbai. Women have to kind of go walk miles for a pot of water. Local tribals are not admitted to the schools there. And women have had no opportunities to discuss sexual health, health, condoms, and as such have no knowledge of HIV/AIDS. So my appeal to this panel is that global funders not only need to look at endemic nations, but also countries like India, where HIV/AIDS is growing steadily, but also not to work in partnership with governments, but to maybe mobilize and compel them to provide a holistic and all-inclusive healthcare system. And I also appeal to all of us gathered here, whether we are AIDS activists, researchers, clinicians, in general, all those who care about HIV/AIDS, to hold our governments accountable for every dollar that is spent or not spent on HIV, and for every death that occurs due to lack of prevention or lack of healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you. Thank you very much for putting this important panel together. My name is Nada Ali, and I'm with the Women's Rights Program at Human Rights Watch in New York. I just would like to highlight some, an important issue that both Aditi and Mr. Songane mentioned, and this is the importance of integrating a human rights approach to any interventions to strengthen healthcare facilities and healthcare systems in general, and especially programs to enable women to benefit from some of the programs that are available. Last year, we conducted research in two provinces in Zambia, where we identified certain abuses such as gender-based violence and insecure property rights that actually undermine women's ability to access testing, to start ARVs, or to adhere to ARVs. So when we also interviewed healthcare providers in different facilities providing ARVs, we found out that they actually do not screen for gender-based violence, and there are no interventions to enable healthcare workers to help women or to refer women to organizations that could help them. So I think that one way to strengthen healthcare facilities is to introduce programs and initiatives that would enable healthcare providers to detect and respond to gender-based violence and other abuses, and also to provide programs that would empower people living with HIV and AIDS and patients in general to seek redress for any violations, including within the healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Henry Kansembe. I'm coming from Zambia. I work in the Ministry of Health and Planning Department. I'm trying to contribute to the debate with respect to contribution of international funding initiative on health system strengthening. Maybe the better question for us to ask ourselves, especially the panel, is what is the source of the complaint from our developing countries? Because otherwise, we end up just justifying ourselves and think that we're actually building systems when we are not. From my perspective, I think that maybe we can search for the answer by looking at the building blocks, you know, of their systems, and looking at them one by one and see what is the impact of these initiatives on each one of them. In Zambia, for instance, we have a swap arrangement where we encourage all donors to pool funds. And I can say here that, for instance, global funds are not part of that arrangement. But worse than that, you know, the planning cycle for the global funds is not aligned to the planning cycle for the rest of the Ministry of Health in the country. And also predictability of releasing funds, you know, funds can be approved 2 years along the way, we still don't get the money. There is big variances between what we put in the budget and ultimate expenditure because money is coming at different times. So at the end of the day, when the annual reports are produced by Ministry of Finance, you find a big variation between expenditure and budgets because we do not know our actual resource envelope. In terms of human resource, quickly, there could be some contribution from funding initiative, but we also know that they are also attracting personnel from the public health systems, the clinic officers and the nurses we train to go and work in these projects, especially USAID. So we have to look at, you know, what's the source of the complaints before we can give a definitive answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm going to take just a few minutes over the time so that we can get these comments in, because I think it's really important to get your voice here. Yes.
My name is Monica Kamaliani. I work for Oxfam International. Two quick comments. Why Almata failed or it didn't work? I think because it was seen as a cheap option of providing health care. You train volunteers, they sit in the community, they talk to women, forget about hospitals, forget about doctors and nurses. And the world community, the international community so-called, forgot that doctors and nurses don't grow in trees. They have to go through, guess what? Primary, secondary, and tertiary education, which were considered, tertiary education was considered as for the elite. So we don't have doctors and nurses, by the way, nor pharmacists, nor lab technicians, nor other health workers. So that's my first point. My second point, as public health physician, what really frustrates me about this debate of HIV health system is that how much it can actually happen on the ground that you can integrate HIV service with health system service. And the question for the Global Fund, for PEPFAR, for the World Bank, for others, is that just three quick examples of if the HIV money is going to build a primary health care unit or a clinic, are you going to put the HIV sign on it, or are you going to provide service for everybody? And because guess what, you know, HIV kids or HIV parents' kids, they do need vaccination. And by the way, they do get pneumonia, and they do need diagnosis and treatment, just like everybody else. So unless this financing will finance HIV and other service at infrastructure level. Second thing, you know, we would have that debate if we don't do that. So quickly, if you train a health worker and give them money to provide only HIV service, then you're pulling the workers from the maternity ward. Now, if they get money for providing service, and then they will not go from there to the HIV ward. You will have everybody trained on HIV, maternity ward and non-maternity ward, and everybody providing service. There's more examples that can happen on ground.
I know. I'm already in trouble with the organisers. I'm going to give 15 to 30 seconds for just two final responses from up here who haven't spoken a second time. Rilake and from Gorek, please.
Would I be allowed to speak afterwards?
No, I'm being told we've got to finish the session, so Rilake...
Should I stand here or not? That's what I'm asking.
No, I'm so sorry. Okay. I'm so sorry.
You should at least tell us that.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I think really as we talk and we talk about strengthening health systems, it's a good thing we're having this topic, this talk now, because like we all have said, one thing HIV has thrown up is really exposed the weakness in our healthcare settings, and it's asking us what then can we do and what should be done to strengthen this. And even we go back and we talk Alma Ata, which is supposed to be public health for all within a single policy framework. But is that what we have? Okay, public health. Where is the public health? Who are those really who will strengthen public health? Are they accessing their own healthcare from that same system? If not, then what really do we have in place to support the majority of the people? And is it really within one policy framework? Or are we working from a million and one agendas and trying to see how we can merge everything together? I think these are the things that we really need to look at as we talk about HIV and the role it can do in strengthening health systems. Personally, what has happened with HIV is it has strengthened, and we should be looking for how then can we do more to foster the strength and to make sure that we get more things done with what we have available for HIV.
Thank you. And Gorit, you gave us a brilliant opening. Give us 30 seconds as a finish.
Okay. I live in a country with a very high standard of health care. It is so high that it is unaffordable and unsustainable for most of the people living in Belgium. It only is because we share the burden, because there is permanent solidarity among the people. Now, if we could extend that permanent solidarity to the rest of the world, only 1 or 2% of what we're spending in Belgium, then we could indeed increase the level of expenditure in Mozambique from $9 to $40 per person per year, and then we could start paying decent wages to nurses in Malawi, etc. If we continue to look only at national economies, sorry, some countries are simply too poor, and that is why Alma Ata failed.
That's it. Thank you so much. Give a round of applause to our fantastic panel, and thank you for being here.